Roots Race and Culture is made possible in part by the contributions to PBS Utah from listeners like you. Thank you.
Hey, my friends, you're listening to Roots, Race, and Culture, the podcast from PBS Utah.
If you like what you hear, we hope you'll subscribe, leave us a review, and share with your friends.
All right, now let's get this thing started.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Roots, Race, and Culture, where we bring you into candid conversations about shared cultural experiences. I'm Daynor Gerald.
And I'm Lonzo Liggins. Today's discussion may certainly take you by surprise as we learn about the history of black churches in Utah. We've got two dynamic guests with us to shed some light on the subject.
Salt Lake City's Trinity African Methodist Episcopal Church was founded way back in the 1880s, before Utah even became a state, making it the oldest black church in Utah. And we're pleased to welcome the current pastor of Trinity AME Church into the studio today, Reverend Daryl Jackson. Set it off for us. Tell us a little bit about you.
Like you said, I'm Reverend Daryl Jackson, the pastor of Trinity AME Church. I am a native, which is awesome. I'm native of Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay. Wow.
Yes, and then I also have, I'm a military vet, spent 29 years in the military between the United States Marine Corps and the Utah Army National Guard.
Well, thank you so much for your service, sir. We appreciate that very much.
Well, yes, and then of course we have the legendary Pastor Franz Davis, the one and only. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you. I came to Utah in 1972. I've been here 50 plus years serving as pastor of Calvary Baptist and professor here on the University of Utah's campus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Calvary's been around for a while as well,
Calvary's
right?
Calvary's been around, longer than sainthood. It was started and established by 1892. And statehood is 1896.
Wow, so these are both institutions that have been around and really helped lay the foundation for the black community here in the state. That's fantastic. You know,
there used to be a time that all of the organizations that were in the African American community were either started by Calvary Baptist or Trinity African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Wow. You know, the thing about the black church in America, it has been really influential in our community forever. And, you know, in fact, Representative John Lewis, who, you know, rest in peace, was a staunch civil rights worker, served for many years afterwards in the House of Representatives for the state of Georgia, has a quote where he's talking about how faith interacted with the whole civil rights movement when it came to the black church. So the quote is here, "The civil rights movement was based on faith. Many of us who were participants in this movement saw our involvement as an extension of faith." Mm-hmm. And that brings me to you, Reverend Davis. You were a participant in the civil rights movement. You were a worker.
In fact, I knew John Lewis. He and I marched together on the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama.
Wow.
And I was with him here. I have a picture of he and the president of this university when he spoke here on this campus.
Wow.
Wow. So did you feel like your participation in the civil rights movement, marching and those things, was that an expression of your faith in God?
It was a major expression of my faith. Dr. King taught us that to believe is one thing, but to believe and to put into practice what one believes is essential. That's what we were trying to do with the civil rights movement. Put it into practice.
Did you have an opportunity to meet Dr. King?
I met Dr. King personally. I was there when he marched on Washington and delivered his most famous speech, "I Have a Dream." Mm-hmm. And I was also there when he delivered "How Long, Not Long" in Montgomery, Alabama.
Wow, that was stunning.
And I had an opportunity to interview him as a reporter for my school newspaper.
Wow. So this was a really big part of your life. So now I want to shift gears to the state of Utah. So did you live, I mean, you were a native.
Yeah, born and raised here in
Yeah,
Utah.
What part of Utah are you from?
I grew up in Salt Lake City.
Oh, that's right. You went to West High.
I graduated
school.
From West High.
Yeah.
I won't give you the year, but I graduated.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, like, what was the civil rights movement like here? Did the church have any involvement in it? Do you remember those days or any?
No, to be honest, I don't. I don't recall, you know, as far as the church is concerned, as far as civil rights. Mm-hmm. But I just know as me growing up during that time, you felt the effect. I felt the effect through my parents, you know, of through conversation, listening to them of, you know, the things that were taking place that were happening.
Back in those days.
And the Black church was involved here locally, historically, in terms of the civil rights movement. People like Victor Gorton, for example, and Reverend W.I. Munro, the pastor of Calvary Baptist at the time, were very active in terms of the movement.
So were they creating marches or demonstrations or things like that? I mean, how?
Marches, they were leading efforts. They were up on Capitol Hill talking to legislators about the need to bring about positive change. And as leaders in the community, they were the spokespersons.
I think it's interesting that from what I've read, the Black community originally in Utah was up near the Olympus area. So up near the Cottonwood Heights area, and that was where the Black community was. And then it eventually kind of spilled over into all of Salt Lake City.
Well, that's later on in the 1820s, the Black community was more downtown on 7th South and 6th South. And that's where the Calvary and Trinity were both located.
That's why those churches have that prime real estate.
Yeah. And just from what I understand and from what I know, that's just kind of where the local Black community around that same area on the East Side, 2nd East, 3rd East, that's where they, that's where a lot of them lived during that.
Yeah, because there's up in the area where you're talking about, though, is where a number of the Black LDS, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, were centered. And there was one in particular that lived in that area, and his family remained there. He owned much of the property in that area.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I can't remember the name of him. Do you remember the name of the guy that lived up in that area?
Well, there was Elijah Abel, there was Hartley, and Green Flake. And Green Flake family still lives here in the area.
That's who it was. And they recently did a little memorial about him. I remember that. I have a question for both of you. So I know we have Trinity AME, we have Calvary. And I know that there's been a few other Black churches in the area around that time. Do you know, can you speak on what other churches were here? Because we have Faith Temple that's here, right?
There are about 30 African-American, predominantly African-American congregations in the Salt Lake, Ogden, and Davis County areas.
Right now.
So those 30 churches consist of a majority of African-Americans who live in this community.
Hmm. Wow, so that's a surprising fact.
No one would have thought that.
Right. In Utah, no one would think that there would be 30 Black churches that are in and around the areas. And I think historically, like the two churches that you have been the ones that have been the oldest, correct?
Yes, those are the oldest. And out of Calvary has come New Pilgrim, which is now The Point.
Yes.
And later on, the church in Ogden, which was Wall Street, it's now New Pilgrim, and out of New Zion, and out of New Zion has come Second Baptist, which is also in Ogden.
Yes, I went to that church, Second Baptist Church, and at the time it was Reverend Pastor Martin.
Yeah, we have a church, a sister church that's in Ogden, Embry. Chapel, AME Church. So there's two AME churches here.
Now those are
state of Utah.
How many pastors has there been since you've taken over the church? Because you've got to be like, didn't you?
Yeah, were speaking we kind of spoke on that, right? So I'm probably I probably number like 50, somewhere between 50 and 55th pastor of Trinity AME Church, and it's because we're in the auspices of our bishop, so we only get orders once a year. right? So we go to every annual conference. So we only get orders once a year. So sometimes you're there for a while. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're there for a year. Just depends on where the bishop needs you.
Yeah. Well, you know,
pastors in general did not stay in Utah for long periods of time because there was no opportunity for upward mobility, educationally speaking, and the churches were relatively small. Aside from Calvary and Trinity, the churches here, there was nowhere else to go in terms of promotion to any other place other than those churches.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, the history of this Christian faith, you know, in the African-American community is interesting because way back in the early days when the slave owners felt like by introducing Christianity to us, because, you know, Africans, Christianity was not really big over in Africa in those days, but they felt like that was a way to pacify these people against their oppression, right? And it actually did not have that impact, because you mentioned the civil rights movement, obviously, was based on faith. But even way back in the day, Nat Turner, who had a very famous violent slave rebellion, his interpretation of the Bible and some of the sort of prophetic experiences that he was having, supernatural experiences, is what gave him the impetus to start this rebellion. And
well,
what are your
Frederick
thoughts about
Douglass
that?
Also was another person who learned how to speak and became a good spokesman for the early civil rights movement during the 1860s. Mm-hmm. It was the 1950s and 60s that Martin Luther King then later on became the leader of the modern civil rights movement. But it was all rooted in the African-American churches. Yeah. And out of those churches came the impetus to lead the movement for civil rights.
And that brings me to this idea of this, like the oral tradition, how much the black churches have kept our culture alive and given people opportunities to develop like these amazing oratory skills and memorization. I mean, you have to write a new sermon every week. That's a lot of work.
he could probably speak more on it than I can, but just in my time of being a pastor, and you know, you don't want to repeat.
Right.
You don't want to repeat your sermon, so you're working on one.
That's 365. Wait, 52 weeks. That's 52 sermons a year, right? Something around that.
And for many of us, it was more than that. There were two sermons per Sunday, or three in my case, at Calvary Baptist. I preached at 8 a.m., at 11 a.m., and at 7 p.m. And
they were different
sermons that were each of those three time periods. And I also preached at other churches like Trinity AME Church and other churches in the afternoon, 3:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah. I mean, that is a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And there's an archive at the Marriott Library here in Salt Lake City on this campus, University of Utah, that has copies of many of the sermons that I have written.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes. And speak on that archive a bit, because that archive is something that also is a collection of stuff within the black community as well, correct?
It was started by Alberta Henry. Alberta Henry donated her papers, and then I was the second person to donate my papers and my work that I had done.
Oh, that's right.
We are still collecting information from the African American community so that we can have a better access to a larger archive for research purposes for here on campus and elsewhere.
That's great.
I have to use that to get some stuff for the
show. Yeah, and you know, go ahead.
On the lines of archives that I have a cousin, D.H. Oliver, who is one of the first lawyers here in as a black lawyers here in Utah. But he has a book that was written, and they have just digitalized it and it's now part of the university's archives also.
And that book is called Black on Negro, A Negro on Mormonism,
yes.
That was written by D.H. Oliver.
Yep.
And it has been now digitized.
Yes.
I have also written several books since I've been here, one on the history of Black Baptists in Utah, another on my own history here in the state of Utah.
Wow.
But those books are available, and they are in as a part of the archive that Brother Reverend Jackson was talking about.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great tradition in the Black church. And Dana and I had a wonderful opportunity to go to Trinity AME and see some of that gospel choir singing.
We
and we actually
that.
Have a video of that up here that we want to go ahead and watch and take a look at. And we want to speak on that afterwards.
There it is.
This is it. This is your church right here.
So this idea of preserving our culture, our music, I mean, if the church isn't there, do you think that's going to happen as easily in our community?
Not as easily. There is here at this station, KUED, a copy of Calvary's choir singing, for example, back in the 70s. It won't be easy to maintain the oral tradition that has been historically a part of our communities.
And what's interesting to me is that so many popular musics have sprang from gospel music. I mean, you have, you know, a lot of blues, you have rhythm and blues, you have even, you know, elements of hip hop that have been taken from that. Could you both speak on that a little bit? We'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just, you know, because when we sing, you know, as far as our choir, you know, they kind of stay in the element of the old gospel music, some of the Negro spirituals and so forth. But myself, I kind of progress out there where some of, even though it's kind of like, say, hip hop, but it's gospel hip hop that, you know, it's formed from the oral tradition of gospel music.
Yes.
There are all kinds of forms of music. It started with Negro spirituals that were popularized without written music and without any written music. People sang what they felt. Later on, they added to that jazz beat, and they made it gospel music. And from gospel music, it became rhythm and blues, and then rhythm and blues later on became hip-hop.
Soul.
And nowadays, hip-hop and soul are the two primary musics that are sang in the African-American community.
Yeah.
They also are sang all over the world by people trying to mimic African-Americans in terms of the singing. In Japan, for example, they sing the Negro spirituals. And people are always trying to mimic the African American community by singing their particular types of music.
Well, I've always said that, like, the African American community is probably the greatest cultural exporting community in the world.
Absolutely.
Like, people know our music, they know our style of how we speak, they know how we dress, they know how we dance, and they emulate it all over the world. And the roots of all of that culture is the Black church, which is why it's so important. And, you know, you mentioned music, and you also mentioned the Black members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I've actually participated in a big celebration with Gladys Knight was a choir director, and we sang gospel music, which that gospel music is not a thing. It's slowly becoming a little more normalized in that church, but it was very well received because of, like what you said, people love it. They feel it. It has an expression of suffering, but also like transcendence at the same time.
And celebration.
Well, just about a month ago, Morehouse Glee Club and Spelma's Glee Club sang with the Tabernacle Choir, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir,
wow.
And then left there and went on down to Calvary Baptist Church, where they were more at home to sure. sing what they were singing.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm curious. I want to take it a little bit local as well. What impact has Trinity AME had on the Black community here in Salt Lake?
Well, I think it's helped keep that social fabric of Black community together. It's a community hub for people to gather. It's kept that spiritual feeling for local Black communities, African Americans, to come to Utah, that come to Utah or are already been a part of Utah, to to be able to be a part of the African church.
Let me ask you this question, like from the heart, like in your position, do you feel any pressure? Like if people come and they move to this state and they're trying to find a church or a home, do you feel like any pressure as the pastor of this historic Black church of providing that? Or how does that impact you when you know that you're one of the few places people can go to and get that feeling of home, like you said?
I don't know necessarily if I feel pressure.
That's good.
That they have to, be, we'd love them to be. We open our doors for those reasons, for those that are, again, in that case, that are coming in, from other states and looking for a home, especially African Americans, to be able to come to a space and where they feel at home, where they can feel at home.
Yes.
But I saw an Asian man at church over there.
We try to be diversified at the, at the same time, and the doors are open to everybody.
So same question for you, Pastor.
There was only one African American that was a college president here in the state of Utah. She was president of the college down in Price, Utah. And before she made a decision to come to Utah, she insisted on an opportunity to talk to the pastor of Calvary and other African Americans that were at the University of Utah and so forth, in order to make her decision. She then made her decision to come here. She served as president of that college for about 3 years, and then she left, and now she's a college president on the East Coast of the United States of America. Wow. But her decision was made by her talking to African-American pastors and African-American professionals who were here in the community. So the pressure you're talking about is real. It's real for those of us who are well-known in the community, and it's been real for people moving to Utah. The University of Utah now has about 40 African-American professors, for example. And of that 40, I would say half of them talked to an African-American pastor before they made the decision to come to Utah. They came from someplace else, and they brought with them their culture, their heritage. Members of Calvary Baptist Church and Trinity AME Church are the professors that are at the colleges nowadays.
Wow.
They are still present at many of those places.
Why do you think they call pastors? I mean, why not call the radio DJ who's Black or somebody else? Why do you think that it is that a lot of folks reach
pastors
out?
Know what's happening in the community. They know where the resources are. They know where the barbershops are. They know where the hairdo places are. They know where the record shops is. They know where the restaurants are. Pastors have their hands in everything. And pastors tend to be in the community the most knowledgeable and the most influential people within the community.
We'll get back to this conversation on Roots, Race, and Culture in just a moment.
PBS Utah is also home to other dynamic podcasts. More Than Half covers some of the most challenging issues facing women in Utah and how it takes all of us to make change happen. Here's a clip from the episode, A Separate Space.
I don't think a lot of people realize that it's just not common for people of color, especially women of color, to see themselves in the stories that, you know, we're reading.
Subscribe to More Than Half wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, back to Roots, Race, and Culture from PBS Utah.
I want to shift gears for a second. You know, I'm thinking about 2020. I'm thinking about Black Lives Matter and these other experiences. I mean, there was a time when people were protesting in Salt Lake City and flipping police cars and
stuff.
Dana
like was
that.
One of them. You...
Well, I
saw him down there on stage flipping the cop cars.
There was, that dude looked like me, but it wasn't me. So I'm wondering, like, how are the churches, the Black churches specifically, dealing with those kind of current event movements that are happening in Black communities?
They're still modeling how to be effective leaders and how to speak, how to keep people from losing their control and flipping police cars, as you say.
They are
still, the Black church still has a major place to play in the lives of all African Americans. Mm-hmm. And whether they are members of the churches or not, they tend to search out pastors in order to get input. When I was pastor of Calvary, for example, the president of the LDS Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints sought me out in order to get my advice on a speech that he was going to give. And not only is it for African Americans, but for non-African Americans as well.
Yeah. Do you agree with that, Pastor Jackson?
I do. I think we have to, as pastors, especially during these times and what you speak of Black Lives Matter, that we, you know, that we're, our presence is felt, that we are a piece where people can come to, you know, whether they need to speak on something, talk about something, let their feelings out, you know, or maybe, as you know, we can give them spiritual advice, you know, about what's taking place, what's going on, and you know,
that's you know, that there's a quote that I want to bring up by Karl Marx, that a lot of commentary about the Black churches and African American experiences in the United States is for, and it's here, this Karl Marx quote: religious suffering is at one and the same time the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. And, you know, that quote is sometimes misrepresented in some ways, but I feel like that's where the connection is between the church and the community and the people. Like you said, you may not be a member of the church, but you still go talk to the pastor, because we've all had this similar shared cultural experience of dealing with suffering. And when you hear something like that, what does that make you think about? Any experiences in your life that you've had, either one of you, or maybe you, Lonzo?
Well, Calvary has been busy, involved in people's lives in every facet. And so we talk about the mission of Calvary being whatever causes people to hurt. So that if people are having housing problems, we build a housing complex. If people are having educational problems, we provide scholarships for people to go to school. If people are politically having problems getting in the system, Sandra Hollins is currently today the only female Black member of the Utah State Legislature, and she's a member of Calvary. So it's Calvary and Trinity that has started many of these movements and then helped people to be able to reach their goal.
You know, I asked
Reverend Jackson earlier about the effect that Trinity has had on the community. Can you tell us more about the effect that Calvary's had on the community?
Well, Calvary has built a housing complex on the corner of 5th East and 7th South. Mm. We have 30 apartments for low-income people, and it is the only church-built, single congregation-built housing complex in the state of Utah. We also have gotten a fair housing bill passed at the state legislature. We have the Mignon Richmond Park and the Martin Luther King Boulevard street
When I got to Utah and I took the exit on downtown, so I was like, Martin Luther King Boulevard, how did that happen?
Calvary Baptist Church and its pastor helped to ensure that that street was named because that's where Trinity is. Yes. That's okay. Where
Central City is
and various other places that African Americans attend. The Mignon Richmond Park is further down that same street.
Yes.
And wow. Mignon Richmond was the first African American to graduate from college here in the state of Utah from Logan.
Wow. I mean, the things that you have done as leaders in the church, the list is amazing and endless. And, you know, you mentioned Dr. King earlier, and I want to ask you a question because you were there at the March on Washington when he gave his famous speech.
Which is incredible.
Can you tell us what it was like to be there and to witness that firsthand?
Well, all day we listened to boring politicians and other speakers speak. But when Dr. King stepped up to the microphone, it was like it turning on electrical power in a dark area. He began to speak and he talked about him having the dream, and it was an exciting time. It was hot, sweltering hot that August day when 250,000 or so people gathered to hear Dr. King. And I just happened to stumble up on it. I was coming from Asbury Park, New Jersey, where I'd been working all summer, going back to Georgia to finish high school, and stumble up on it by seeing all of the outhouses, all of the cars, and all of the people, and then was able to stay and hear Dr. King deliver the speech. It was an exciting time.
Wow.
I mean, you were destined to be there. Thinking about the work that you've done.
I was also there later on when Mr. Obama was first installed as President of the United States of America. And that he saw as a fulfillment of Dr. King's I Have a Dream.
Isn't that amazing? You know, it's incredible just to see, you know, the impact that the Black church has had, especially in Salt Lake City, Utah. Do you feel that since the time, like perhaps that you become pastor and that you become pastor, that you've seen an increase or a decrease of people going into the church, and especially younger people?
Well, from my standpoint and for Trinity's standpoint, that it's been a decrease in young adults, children.
Why do you think that is?
In my case, I think it's just families don't take religion seriously, take God seriously, the church, or they just find other means, you know, whether it's the sea or go out and it's the trees and, you know, that's where I can find, I'm not religious, but I can spiritual. Go and spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. And they just don't need, feel like they don't need God.
Yeah.
Well, I saw a growth in the African-American church in 1972. 1972, we started with about 100, 150 people. When I left the church, we were about 1,000. Mm. So a large growth, young people, middle age, and older people were all a part. But I think the reason for people coming and then later on falling off, as Reverend Jackson mentioned, now they're falling off, is that they think that the church doesn't have a particular place that they can meet God anywhere else, on the golf course, in the at the football game, or wherever they go. And that people think that that's where God is.
But there's a value in it, because I know, you know, we were talking about when a black person moves to Utah, and Dana and I talk about this all the time, sometimes you almost see like there's an expiration date stamped on their forehead about how long they're going to be able to stay in Utah, because they get here, initially they really enjoy it. Initially there's a joy about being here. They feel like there's, you know, there's fresh air, you know, there's plenty of outdoor space, but then they get to a point where they kind of start feeling like they're really not a part of things. And I know that you've spoken about, you know, what it is that makes it so that if you're African American, you're moving here, what creates more of a feeling of home? Because you two are here for life, right? I mean, I don't think y'all are going to move anywhere. So what is it that makes it so that you two are here for life? And what is it that could help other African Americans who move here be a part of the church and become a part of this community for life?
Well, I thought about that after we chatted the other day, and was reminded that people who are connected tend to stay. But people who are individuals and disconnected tend not to stay. And after a while, they find this a bad place to be. They think about the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints is years of when they believed that African Americans were cursed and therefore not to be a part. Mm-hmm. But they forget about since 1978 that has officially changed. There's still people with attitudes that still have to change.
That's what it is.
And the attitudes is the big problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just, you know, on speaking on that, as connection, as he says, is family. When mm-hmm. you're connected and you're family, you know, or you feel like you're part of a family, mm-hmm. whether it's by blood or just being connected and getting involved into that community, mm-hmm. you know, if you're not interwoven into it, then you tend to, you know.
Because you felt that growing up here, because I remember we talked the other day, you said, hey, look, I had a great time growing up in Utah because I was always connected with the church.
I was connected with my community.
Yeah.
With the back then was the Elks Lodge, which was a very big thing. That's where we held, you know, that's where everybody went. The Elks, you know, you had your Easters, you had your Christmas, you go to what's the park off of the Jordan Peace Gardens, Park. Jordan Park. You go to Jordan Park, you have your barbecues and your baseball games, football games, you know, but it was a community.
Yeah.
And everybody was involved.
Yeah, yeah.
That reminds me of growing up down south when you described
that. I want to talk about the elephant in the room that you brought up, okay? The LDS Church. So now we know it's hard to speak about the black church and the black in Utah without talking about an element in the church, which was the Genesis group. Can we speak on that? Tell us.
Well, there's this group that the LDS Church created back in 1971 with the help of a couple of black members, young men who worked with church leadership. And it's a place where they can have their own black church experience once a month, basically. All the blacks in the church are welcome to come and worship together. Anybody's welcome through the doors, but it's really, you know, kind of made for black folks, and they sing gospel music and that kind of a thing. And it started in 71, but as you mentioned, Reverend Davis, they really didn't change their policy about equality. They had this racial discrimination all the way till 1978. So there was a lot of tension in this state, in the black community at that time, because this dominant organization had a racist policy. And what was it like back in those days?
Well, for African Americans who were not a part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter Saints, it meant that we were left alone. We were not subjects to be proselyted. by the LDS Church and by the missionaries that rode the bicycles and ride up and down. They would mysteriously be on one side of our house, and then the next time you see them, they'd be on the other side of our house.
They would knock on your door.
Which for wouldn't. Some people kind of be a nice thing.
So it was nice in that regard.
Yeah.
But the day that the revelation came down, which said that now all eligible males can hold the priesthood, when I got to my office, all of the major television stations were there, and they wanted to know from me what I thought was going to be the impact. And I told them there'd be no impact in terms of the African Americans who were outside of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Fortunately, the attitudes, the people at the top had made a decision that they were about to change. But the people down below never understood that decision and never made the attitude change.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like that's still the case?
Still the case.
Yes.
Still the case. Missionaries, I see them in my community, and I'm the only African-American who live in my community. But I see them next door, and the next time I see them, they're next door on the other side of my house.
But well, maybe they know this is Pastor Davis. Like he already got his deal with God. We ain't got to worry about it.
Maybe they do know that.
Yeah.
But it was a tense time because people like Darius Gray, who helped to start the Genesis Group, is still alive here in the community.
And big part Darius, of the Black LDS community, yeah.
Big part of it, but also a big part of the African-American community. And so he's still here and still working to make changes.
I think that the African-American church in Salt Lake City has seen a lot of changes in the Black community here. And over the course, at least of your tenures, you know, as preachers, what changes have you really drastically seen happen over the course of your career with our community? One thing I've personally noticed here is that it seems that the Black community kind of stays the same as far as the percentage-wise, you know, but what other changes have you seen in the community? Let's start with you, Pastor Jackson.
Well, unfortunately, I'd say for myself and just the experience, I think it's been, it hasn't been a good experience. Mm-hmm. And I take it from the point of view of my son, who's a senior in at Hillcrest High School, mm-hmm. and plays sports. But he's already had incidents, which is sad to say, mm-hmm. where he's had been called out of his name in a sports arena, mm-hmm. By white Caucasian gentlemen, older gentlemen, and not knowing, you know, I mean, you're on the football field, you're coming off the football field, and you're getting called outside of your name, which
racial
is
epithets.
Yeah, which is, you know, which is sad. We still have to deal with those type, and you would think that at this point, especially for me, that my son wouldn't have to go through those.
You know, well, deals. I have a daughter who is in her early 50s, and she refuses to come to Utah because of those kind of four-letter, six-letter words that were used toward her. When she was a class officer at her high school, she went to Skyline High School and was a class officer, but people told her, you can't do so and so and so, and you can't do so and so and so because you're Black. But so she refuses to, she'll come to visit us for a couple of days, and then she's out of here.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is, growing up down south, I lived in Mississippi, Texas, and you know, I had all those same things that I experienced growing up there.
But you don't expect them here in Utah, though, and that's the difference.
Right.
You don't expect them, and they are more underneath, more hidden, more
subversive.
You
know, and then it's because of that, if you feel like they get blindsided, like you said, your son was like
blindsided.
You know, you don't see it coming, and. Right. And it has a more traumatic effect on the person, I think, because of that.
Right.
She doesn't want to have that experience again.
Right.
Your son may end up like thinking, man, I'm out of here and not wanting to come back. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, when I first came to Utah, I was denied housing because there was no fair housing available to people who were coming, who were African-American and coming from outside.
So it was like they were redlining or?
They just simply said to me, you can't. You pay the deposit, you have a phone installed, but you can't live here. So I lived in the International House, which is just up the hill from where you stay where you are now, for the first year that I was here, because there was no fair housing.
So you could rent, but you couldn't own, is basically what you're saying.
You couldn't rent in certain parts east of Foothill Boulevard, was off limits for African Americans. Didn't
That's
matter
wild.
That you had the money. There also were lines in real estate contracts which said that you couldn't sell your house to a person of African of servant class. They used the term servant class.
Wow.
And they considered African Americans of servant class.
Well, that really is a perfect example of what you guys have been talking about, what you gentlemen have been talking about, of why these black churches are so important to the community. The changes that are needed are initiated there. They are talked about there. They are built there. That's where the good things have been happening for us as a people for hundreds of years.
All over the country, and not just here in Utah, but all over the country, and specifically here in Utah. There's the housing complex that we built, for example, is the finest housing complex in inner city Salt Lake City, that the tenants will tell you. But there haven't been a whole lot of that.
Well, as we wrap it up, I want to just offer you gentlemen an opportunity to give us some parting words about your faith. As was mentioned at the beginning, you know, faith is a big part of these movements, of these efforts. It's not just doing it because we look alike, it's doing it because you feel it's right. What would you share as you know, last words that you would want people to know or feel about this experience that you've had as Utah black church leaders?
Well, I would say from Psalm 16, verse 6, the lines are drawn in pleasant places. Yes, we have a goodly heritage. And I would remind people that in spite of the problems, it's still a good place to live.
And I guess that's, you know, just on that, I mean, the reason why we're still here is because we do feel like it's a good place, so, you know, to live, even through the struggles, even through the things that we've gone through as myself growing up in Utah, to what I've experienced, you know, that we haven't talked about, certain things, and my son. But it is a good place to be, and it's, for some reason, it's more of a safe place to be, a safer place to be, and I think that needs to be shared with, you know, the black community. And I see some, and I talk to some that come in that I've run across and come in from different states, and they say, you know, Utah is a better place than where I came from, you know, and more opportunity than where I came from to have a better life. Wow. Here in Utah.
Wow, a lot of layers, man. Thank you.
Yeah, that's
thank
you so much.
There were 10 African Americans hired the year that I came here by this university, and of those 10, only two of us have stayed here. The others have went on to higher grounds and better places and better opportunities elsewhere. But living here for me and my family has been a good deal.
Well, good for you. I think that's amazing. It's been such a pleasure having you both on the show and learning so much more about the history of AME, the history of Calvary, and just your amazing life story of seeing Dr. King, John Lewis, and I could sit here for hours and pick your brain about that.
But we don't have hours.
But anyway, thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming out.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Legendary.
I appreciate it. Thank you,
Pastor Franz Davis, and of course, legendary Pastor Daryl Jackson.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Roots, Race, and Culture.
Check out our website for more content, information about our guests, and other episodes. You can find all that in a bag of chips at pbsutah.org/roots.
And you'd be doing us a solid if you told all your friends about our show. But until next time, y'all, we are out.